This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 83 was recorded on October 5th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. We're airing part two of our Eurodollar University with Alhambra Partners CIO Jeff Snyder as this week's feature interview. Now, for any new listeners who aren't familiar with this project, Jeff Snyder has been one of our most popular guests ever. But even the finance professionals in our audience have complained that Jeff goes so deep into the Eurodollar system in his analysis that some background was needed to explain how the system works. So we asked Jeff to put together a full show on the history and workings of the Eurodollar system, and before we knew it, we had four full shows instead of one. We aired part one of our Eurodollar University in episode 78 of Macro Voices, which aired on August 31st, and it got rave reviews. Now, while I learned quite a few things from part one, frankly, I already knew a lot of the material that it contained. But when we got into the wholesale Eurodollar system in parts two, three, and four, I was completely blown away. I had no clue previously about the extent of the Eurodollar system and the role that it has played in financial markets. I think parts 2, 3, and 4 are some of the best and most unique content that we've ever produced. So if you didn't already listen to part 1 back on August 31st, I recommend you go back and listen to it first. You can find every single Macro Voices episode back to day 1 at macrovoices.com free of charge. Just scroll down on the homepage and look for Jeff Snyder's picture. And be sure to stay tuned for today's post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will both give you our own perspectives on part 2 and also a sneak preview of what's coming in parts 3 and 4, as well as when you can expect us to release them.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, the S&P 500 keeps powering higher, making an all-time new high each week. What's your feeling here on equities?
You know, Patrick, we should probably just save the recording of you asking that question so we can use it over every week, because it seems like every week it's the same story of new all-time highs. As you remember, just a couple weeks ago, we were flirting with 2,500 round number resistance. I mentioned that a lot of technicians were targeting 2,526 as the next upside target, and that sounded high, like, oh boy, how could we possibly go a whole another 25 points higher? Well, here we are a couple weeks later and 50 points higher with the S&P futures touching 2550 this afternoon. So, it just continues. We're definitely in the late stages of a bull market where rational economic logic gets thrown out the window and sentiment takes over, and it's crazy buying stuff. One thing I do want to debunk, a lot of people have been saying, oh, but it's October. You know, that's when market crashes happen. So just wait. We're in the first days of October. It really doesn't work that way. If you look at the history of the so-called October crashes, of which there are many on record, really, those started in September. The general pattern is that the top happens sometime in August, usually late August. Then you get all kinds of volatility and craziness in September. And the worst of it is in October. And that's the reason everybody remembers October as the crash month. But it would have started by now if we were going to follow that pattern, and it hasn't. And, you know, remember, the lion's share of the upside in a market comes in the mania stage. I think we're definitely in that mania stage. Is it time to think it's going to end, though? I doubt it. I mean, it ought to. I think it should roll over, and I think the fair value of the market is much lower. But I don't think it's about to end. I'm happy to not participate in this market, but that's just my style. I don't invest in things unless I believe in the fundamental argument, and I don't believe in this market. But I do think it has plenty of room to run much higher on irrational momentum. If you want to play this market to the upside, I think you definitely want to be thinking about options to limit your downside, trend following strategies, things that are designed to be sure that you are quick to get out when the trend reverses. I don't think we're there yet, but when it happens, it's going to be ugly. As far as the bearish look, I think the best gift that the bears could ask for at this point would be a huge move up, let's say 3,000 on the S&P by Christmas. Now, that would be something that you could make a strong argument for why to sell it short. You know, that would be the parabolic final move up to a blow-off top. We haven't seen anything like that. This is still showing signs of being a healthy uptrend. Definitely overextended, though. We are at an extreme overbought situation. There ought to be at least some kind of pullback now, but I think it's going to be a healthy pullback, a buy-the-dip opportunity, and further upside from here. Eventually, this will end very badly, but I don't think it's time yet.
Now, what's your views on the U.S. dollar index? Where's the dollar hitting next?
Well, the bounce looks pretty darn healthy so far. I mean, this looks like a good, solid uptrend as we're speaking, just coming into the close on Thursday afternoon. We're looking at 93.79 on the December dollar index futures contract. And, you know, that's a pretty healthy recovery from the low that we had around 91. Now, keep in mind, though, that it's too early to call this game in the sense that even if the major trend has developed to the downside, well, a 50% retracement would be very typical after such a big move as we've seen to the downside before a further sell-off continues. A 50% retracement would take us back up to a 97 handle. So, you know, we've got plenty of further upside to go before we could really decide. It's really as you move north of 103 where you say, okay, the secular dollar bull market is still intact. So we're still in a wait-and-see phase. As far as the longer-term picture for the dollar is concerned, let's save that for our post-game segment after the interview with Jeff Snyder, because I want to allow the audience to be informed by Jeff's comments. Obviously, Eurodollar University is all about the Eurodollar system. Let's start with that, and we'll come back and revisit the longer-term picture on the dollar index after the feature interview.
Now let's move on to crude oil. It's certainly some crazy price action here. What's your thinking on oil?
Well, as I mentioned last week, that cup and handle formation targeting 52 to 53 completed. 52 spot 88 was the high. So we rolled over as I predicted we would, a little bit later than I predicted that we would, but indeed we did. Inventory this week, crude oil drawing down 6 million barrels, Cushing, Oklahoma building 2.1 million barrels, gasoline building 1.6 million barrels, distillates drawing down 2.6 million barrels. Now, overall, with that big crude drawdown and a build in gasoline, but a relatively small build in gasoline compared to the very large drawdown in crude oil inventories, you know, that's a pretty bullish report overall. Production ticked up 14,000 barrels to 9.561 million barrels per day. The thing is, that of course sent prices rocketing to the upside. That rally only lasted about 45 minutes. We had fully retraced back to pre-data levels within 45 minutes, and within several hours we were trading much, much lower than before the data came out. So in the face of such bullish information, you really have to ask yourself, or such a bullish report, I should say, you really have to ask yourself, well, what happened? Why wasn't that big drawdown going to send prices much higher? And why are they actually selling off lower? I think the reason is we saw another jump up to 1.984 million barrels per day of exports. Now, the exports are reported a million barrels per day. The builds and draws are a weekly number. So let's translate that times seven. We get 13.9 million barrels exported from the United States during this reporting period. Well, that means our 6 million barrel drawdown, if you still had the environment we had very recently where it was illegal to export crude oil from the United States, that would have been a 7.9 million barrel build in the old normal system when you couldn't export. Now that we're exporting, we sent 13.9 out of the country, so now what would have been a 7.9 build becomes a 6 million barrel draw. So, you know, if we knew for sure whether or not that oil was being exported for consumption or just being exported because it was economic to move it and store it someplace else, then we could make an intelligent decision about whether or not that really counts or not in terms of rebalancing or evaluating whether supply and demand are rebalancing. So I think that what we've really come to is a point where with exports now being legal, it's much harder to tell from EIA inventory data whether or not supply and demand is in balance or not. not? You know, and how do you correctly interpret this? Do you say, well, that 13.9 million barrels, you know, we adjusted out, it's equivalent to a 7.9 million barrel build? Do you say that? Or do you say, no, wait a minute, it's a different world. We exported that oil. It's gone. It's a 6 million barrel draw. We don't have it in inventory anymore. It's not in storage. How do you interpret that? There's probably good arguments on either side of that. The point is the picture has changed dramatically from what it was a year ago when we didn't have legalized export of crude oil. So we sold all the way down to 49.76, trading on a 49 handle for most of Wednesday afternoon. Thursday's strength, I think, is both about Hurricane Nate barreling into the Gulf Coast. Now, of course, Hurricane Harvey was bearish for crude oil prices because of the shut-ins of refineries. Nate is only just barely building to a hurricane strength storm. I don't think it's actually, as we're taping, there yet, although it's predicted to become hurricane strength. It'll probably only get to Category 1. So that has the result of preventive shut-ins in the Gulf of Mexico, shutting production off, but it's very unlikely that this storm would be big enough to affect refining capability. At the same time, we have Vladimir Putin and King Salman from Saudi Arabia meeting in Russia today. Lots of TV coverage of that. That sent us all the way back up to 51.22, the height of the press conference, and it looks like we're starting to retrace back to the downside. So I think the trend... the uptrend is clearly over at this point. We hit that 52.88 high. I doubt that we'll go higher than that. The next downside target would be the 200-day moving average, which perfectly coincides with the 50% Fibonacci retracement, right around 49.52. The next lower target after that would be the 61.8 Fib level at 48.73. Then you get down to a 47.67 target, which would be a formative channel support line. Now, after that, the picture gets quite a bit muddier. I had pretty strong conviction a few weeks ago thinking we're headed to below $40. I'm not convinced of that anymore. Now, frankly, I still think that the balancing or rebalancing of the market that people think is occurring is probably not occurring the way they believe it is. But at the same time, what is occurring is I think that between Saudi Arabia's activity to try to influence where their exports are going so that the accumulation of storage does not happen in the United States where it's most visible through EIA reporting, plus that Brent WTI spread. Now, whether anybody is trying to intentionally game that spread wider or if it's just happening naturally, I'm not sure. But one way or another, we have much lower than usual imports to the United States this week. That's because of the WTI being so much lower than Brent. It's more economic for people in other countries to export into Brent markets rather than into the WTI market. So the combination of where the Saudis are trying to cause their oil to go and that wide Brent WTI spread are leading to drawdowns in perceived inventory, or actually not just perceived, actual inventory in the United States. Is it really a drawdown in global inventory, or is it a shell game that we're moving some things around and it's just coming out of U.S. inventory and into other inventory elsewhere in the world? Well, I can't tell that, but it really doesn't matter. Because if it comes out of U.S. inventory, that's going to cause a lot of people to bid the prices higher. So I am still bearish here from a seasonal standpoint. Seasonality should now be a headwind for oil prices. There's a lot of reasons to think lower, but maybe not quite as low as I was thinking a few weeks ago.
Now let's move on to gold. We clearly had a significant top at 1350. Where do you think gold's going next?
Well, you know, 1281 was a good solid technical level when we talked about that level, but the bounce off of that level only lasted for 2 days. Now, as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon, just after the close, looks like 1269.80 was the low this afternoon, and we're continuing to move lower. This is all about the dollar index, so far as I'm concerned. As long as this dollar bounce continues, then it's a serious headwind for gold, and I think we're looking at lower gold prices. Now, if you are absolutely convinced that the dollar is just dead cat bouncing and is imminently about to roll over and, you know, turn back down into the 80s or something, it's time to buy gold. Jump on it. I don't think that's happening. I think that we're going to see a continued bounce in the dollar index, continued headwind for gold prices. I would consider buying gold when the dollar bounce shows signs of exhaustion or reversal. But until then, you know, unless you think that this is a dead cat bounce, I don't think it's time here. On the other hand, if we were to see the dollar really resume a rally in earnest, you know, say continuing to climb above 100 on the dollar index, gold's in real trouble in that case. I think it would be well below 1,200, maybe even to the 1,100 range that gold would be headed if that were to occur. So my position is, until I have a stronger conviction about where the dollar index is concerned, I'm on the sidelines as far as gold.
Now, 10-year treasuries, Eric, what's your thinking of where the next move for interest rates are going?
Well, we're back up to 2.36 this afternoon on the 10-year yield, and we're continuing to auction back and forth on the middle of this range, which is the trading range is around 2.12 to 2.64. We're right in the middle of that. Looked like we had a breakdown below 2.12 for a while there, and it didn't last, and now we're back up in the middle of the range. I still tend to favor the resolution of this trading range toward lower yields, higher prices, but it remains to be seen.
Well, thanks for the market wrap, Eric, for this week's feature interview. And by very popular demand, we're airing part two of the Lambra Partners CIO Jeffrey Snyder's Eurodollar University, which we recorded back in July. Part two of the Eurodollar University is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
With this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Today's feature interview with Alhambra Partners CIO Jeffrey Snyder was pre-recorded back in July of 2017 as part two of our Eurodollar University project. There's a slide deck to accompany this interview, and we recommend you download it before listening, as we'll be referring to the charts and graphs it contains throughout this program. Registered users at macrovoices.com will find the download link in your research roundup email. If you're not yet registered, go to www.macrovoices.com and look for instructions to register and get the download next to Jeffrey Snyder's photo on our homepage. This four-part series came about after listeners to the Macro Voices weekly podcast asked for more in-depth coverage on the Eurodollar system. In part one, we discussed how the Eurodollar system came about, how Milton Friedman demonstrated in a series of articles that fully $30 billion in new U.S. dollar money supply was created in the Eurodollar system by the end of the 1960s, and how this occurred at the stroke of a bookkeeper's pen, without a single penny of actual cash issued by the Treasury or a single ounce of gold bullion to back this $30 billion of new money supply. So without further ado, let's jump right back in where we left off. Here's Alhambra Partners CIO, Jeffrey Snyder.
So one of the things we have to be aware of is that the word Eurodollar, as I said before, is not a technically precise term. At least the way I use it is not a technically precise term. I use it as a catch-all to describe what is essentially the monetary, radical monetary evolution away from the traditional format that was based on deposits of dollars toward the more indescribable and ill-defined interbank market of these bookkeepers' pen ledger balances moving back and forth. And so the wholesale part of it is just as important as the offshore part of it. I think we want to describe a little more detail what we mean by wholesale finance.
So to elaborate on that point about wholesale, let's move into the next few slides where we're getting to the 1970s. It looks, if I'm getting the gist of this, like maybe the Fed is waking up to the fact that their own money supply statistics are not really accurate because of this growth of euro dollars, which are dollars that exist outside of the banking system that they're regulating. What's going on here with slide 16?
Well, this is from an FOMC discussion from 1974. Where the open market manager, Charlie Coombs, was essentially saying they needed to scrap M1 as a money supply indicator because it was no longer valid. And what he was saying is that they should start focusing on M2, but even M2 was going to become obsolete in the near future, and that they should develop something like M3. And the reason for that was what we talked about before, this revolution in money where the traditional formats that they were used to define before were no longer valid. And at least, you know, remember, this was the great inflation. So one of the basis for the great inflation was the fact that the monetary system itself was becoming unrecognizable to the people who are supposed to be able to define it best and then also control it. And so it was a major, major radical revolution in money supply and in money demand, where the entire system was being used or being defined in ways that were outside of the traditional mechanics of, you know, simple CDs or whatever else is in M1.
And to keep this in context for our listeners, in August of 1971, President Nixon suspended indefinitely, he said temporarily at the time, but it is still suspended, the convertibility of U.S. dollars into gold because there had been effectively a run on the banking system where foreigners had figured out that the U.S. dollar was not really worth the gold it was redeemable for, and people were redeeming gold en masse, and that caused the U.S. to slam the gold window in 71. Then you get inflation starting, and now the government is figuring out, according to this, the FOMC in 74 is figuring out that their traditional measures of money supply don't work anymore. Moving on to slide 17, you've got a quote from Ben Bernanke in 2006 here. How does that fit into this story?
What essentially happened was that in the 1970s, as all of these money supply targets and all of the money definitions were breaking down, many economists noticed it because it was hard not to, essentially, because it was the great inflation after all. And started to investigate what it was going on in the monetary system. And a prominent economist, a Princeton economist, Stephen Goldfeld, wrote what was essentially a famous paper, which he titled The Case of the Missing Money. What Ben Bernanke was referring to was essentially this, the idea that the monetary system was evolving in ways that economists at the time, even today, didn't fully grasp and didn't fully understand. And Stephen Goldfeld, in his paper, went looking for how and why the monetary system was changing and what could be done about it. And what he essentially came up with was the idea that money demand forecasts were off, and often off by a significant amount. And we're on slide 18 now. And his conclusion was that, you know, they would forecast money demand for whether it was M1 or one of the other aggregates, and it would always come up short in the actual money demand. And the reason for it was the undeniable fact that something else was satisfying economic demand for money, which was clear at the time. Again, this is the great inflation. So the fact that, you know, there couldn't have been a tight monetary condition, even though the economists and policymakers at the time didn't know what it was obvious that there was something else monetarily satisfying economic demand for money. And Mr. Goldfeld wasn't able to characterize exactly what that was, other than to clarify that this was indeed happening. And so it became the case of the missing money for at least him in that part of the 1970s, where they weren't sure exactly what it was that was going on. But yet they would continue to investigate. And by the later 1970s, they had identified a couple of different candidates. And among them was the repo market.
Before you go on, Jeff, I want to touch on this point you're making on slide 19, because the definition of Eurodollar that I found on Wikipedia was time deposits of U.S. dollars outside the U.S. banking system. Now, you're saying here that it's not just that. It also includes the transformation of banking into a wholesale model that is free of deposits altogether. That's very much at odds with the definition that I understood. So please explain what you're talking about. What is this wholesale model, and how is it possible for euro dollars to exist if there are not bona fide deposits of U.S. dollars that are on deposit in some bank someplace?
Well, I think, you know, the Wikipedia definition gets back to the same thing Milton Friedman was talking about 50 years ago. Essentially, that we have a very difficult time describing the euro dollar market because it assaults all of our traditional sensibilities about what money is and what it's supposed to be. But the fact of the matter is that we have this wholesale model that is often, some of the later versions of it, completely free of deposits altogether. What we're essentially building are bank balance sheets that are using various forms of liabilities that are not deposits. There are often interbank transactions, all sorts of different kinds of traded liabilities. Now, I know it's a difficult concept, and, you know, we want to describe it more fully, and that's, I think, what we're going to intend to do here. One of the first primary wholesale methodologies is the repo market.
Jeff, before you go on, I just want to test something with you, because the description that I've always heard, you know, if you pose the question, why was the U.S. forced in 1971 to abandon the gold standard, and why did the U.S. begin experiencing this huge inflation that lasted for a decade? what most people would tell you is, oh, well, the answer is excessive spending on the Vietnam War forced the U.S. to essentially not be able to defend the dollar's convertibility to gold. It sounds to me like what you're saying here is this euro-dollar system growing out of control that nobody understood at the time probably has just as big, if not a bigger role than war spending in explaining what happened. Am I correct about that? And please elaborate. What role did euro-dollars play in the decision for the U.S. to go off of the gold standard? And what role did they play in fueling the very large inflation that occurred in the U.S. in the 1970s?
Well, I think the first part is correct. I mean, there was a problem with deficit spending primarily. In Alan Meltzer's terrific history of the Fed, he attributes the great inflation to what he called the even keel policy, where by regulatory requirements, the Federal Reserve had to allow the U.S. Treasury to sell its debt at auction in the best possible manner. In other words, they would increase the level of bank reserves before an auction took place and then remove them afterwards. The purpose behind that was to make sure that the monetary system was sufficiently liquid so that the U.S. Treasury could sell its debt. So when the Vietnam War began to escalate and deficit spending increased also because of the Great Society, the Federal Reserve was adding reserves to auctions, which became more frequent, and then they never removed them. And so essentially they were printing money based on this deficit spending of the Treasury to make sure that the Treasury could always sell its debt at auction. So that was certainly part of it. I think Meltzer's correct about that. And we also have to recognize that philosophically, there was the idea from early 1960, the famous paper by Samuelson and Solow, where they essentially created what they called an exploitable Phillips curve, which was the idea that you could buy lower unemployment through increased inflation using the Phillips curve effect so that, you know, the Treasury deficit monetarily financed would create inflation that would reduce the unemployment rate, which is one of the reasons why Milton Friedman became a Nobel laureate, because he criticized that philosophy as completely wrong. So there's a couple different developments that are apart from the Eurodollar system that do explain the great inflation, but I don't think they're comprehensive. I think we have to be aware of the fact that there's this missing money era where officials weren't really sure about what the money supply of the United States even was. They couldn't define it under their traditional statistics. You know, that was what's so important about the discussion in 1974, was that we have Federal Reserve officials on record talking about the fact that the M1 monetary indicator had already become obsolete. And that there were things going on, you know, according to Stephen Goldfeld's work, where they needed to do more investigation about, you know, how do we define money in the 1970s? And oh, by the way, this is taking place during one of the greatest inflationary episodes in global history because it was a global event. So, you know, I think the Eurodollar story is an important part of that explanation.
Let's go ahead and dive deeper into this, Jeff, as we move on to slide 20 here. We talk about this era of missing money. What's the missing money? Where did it go? And particularly, how does the repo market fit into this story?
The repo market in the 1970s was primarily the biggest missing money component. And you can understand why there was a reluctance to add repos to the monetary definitions at the time, because it didn't seem to fit the idea of money. It's not that officials didn't know that there was this repurchase market out there, because, you know, in some forms, repurchase agreements go back a long ways to the earliest days of the Federal Reserve and in foreign capacities, even farther than that. So the repo market wasn't a new phenomenon. People knew about it. Officials knew about it. But they were reluctant to treat it as a monetary component, because at that time, there was actually no standard definition of what a repurchase agreement actually was. And I think a lot of people have problems when they try to intuitively understand the repo, because it's called a repurchase agreement, and it is in its transaction a sale and a buyback of a security. What exactly are people doing when they're doing that? You know, what is the motivation for a firm to sell a security one day and agree on the same day to buy it back the next day or, you know, further down the road? And it doesn't intuitively make sense, and it certainly doesn't intuitively make sense in a monetary capacity. And in fact, the whole history of the repo market was one of confusion and, you know, irregularity. In official treatment, repurchase agreements were by case treated as either a collateralized loan or an actual purchase and sale of securities. One of the most famous cases of the repo market that established the repo market in 1969 was Union Planters v. U.S., where the courts ruled, rather than clarify what a repurchase agreement was, the courts actually ruled that repos were to be taken on a case-by-case basis. And so, even in earlier, in the 1957, for example, the Office of Comptroller of the Currency had started treating repos as collateralized loans, but then in 1964 decided, well, no, we're not going to do that. We're going to treat them again, like we always have, as actual purchases and sales of securities. So from the outside, even officially, the idea of repo as money might not have seemed like a legitimate explanation for the missing money. But in fact, the way that the banks were actually using these repurchase agreements, as the Federal Reserve Bank of New York found out in the spring of 1979, was that corporations were depositing assets into these other accounts where they would use a repo transaction that would be settled the next day, and then they would use those accounts to undertake monetary transactions. In other words, they would actually write checks against the repo account, even though the funds were segregated outside of the traditional definition of a deposit, and then they would be settled against that account. So even a repo transaction started to act monetarily. And what the Federal Reserve Bank of New York found in 1979 was when they went back and actually tried to quantify the growth of repurchase agreements in the 1970s, what they found was a great deal of this missing money was explained by the rise of the repo market and also other things like money market funds, too. But it was the rise of these things that were outside of the traditional definitions of money. And even though that they weren't defined as money under the deposit schematic, they were being used as money anyway.
So you've described repo transactions. Let's focus on how they fit into this whole missing money equation. As we move on to slide 21, you're saying missing money equals wholesale. What do you mean by that, and how does repo fit into this whole story?
Well, it was missing because the traditional banks or the traditional monetary statistics didn't include it in their definitions because, again, what we said about the complexity and the essentially insanity of the repo markets and how they were operated. And so from the perspective of officials using like an M1 statistics, there was missing money because of, you know, the repo market and other wholesale formats like money market funds that were actually taking place, and they were actually taking on a monetary role outside of the traditional definitions. And so what essentially the repo market was another form of bank liabilities to be traded between banks or even between corporations and banks that didn't meet the traditional or official definitions of money at the time. And so in terms of the missing money era of the 1970s, it wasn't really missing. What was missing was the traditional understanding or the official or mainstream understanding of what money was, because the economy itself, as Stephen Goldfeld described in his paper, was using these various other formats of money to take economic transactions, to undertake economic transactions. So these other forms of money were being used to actually fulfill a monetary role. And it was just the idea that officially we didn't understand, or they didn't understand at the time, exactly how that was taking place or how much it was taking place, which is an important consideration, especially in a period like the Great Inflation, was that, okay, we know these things are taking place, we know they're happening, but how much of it is happening, and to what degree, and to what degree does that affect, you know, the economy at large, inflation, GDP, and all those other kinds of monetary aggregates.
So on slide 22, you're essentially summarizing to say that euro dollars are really two things. The Wikipedia definition is the offshore euro dollars, and you're saying that these wholesale banking transactions create another money supply of U.S. dollars that doesn't really get captured in the official statistics. Moving on to slide 23, we're shifting gears here outside of the 70s, moving forward, I think, into the 80s and 90s, and talking about, you're describing this is off in the shadows, probably bringing into play the so-called shadow banking system. So how do we know how many of these euro dollars are if they're not being captured in the official statistics and what their impact is on the global economy?
Well, you're right. And that's exactly what we're getting into is, you know, people remember from 2008 and the great financial panic then, we started talking about shadow banks and shadow banking, but I don't think it was ever fully described or fully investigated. In fact, I'm pretty sure it wasn't. And the fact is, you know, shadow banking didn't just come out of nowhere. It didn't just spring up in, you know, the middle of the 21st century. In fact, it was a process that had gone back into, you know, this missing money period of the 1970s. And so because it was, you know, this missing money was taking place outside of official definitions, and even though officially, you know, the Federal Reserve and economists worked on various ways to incorporate things like repurchase agreement and money market funds into the official statistics, they often did not have success in doing so. And so a large number or a significant amount of this monetary stuff, this money supply that it doesn't conform to the traditional definitions, was taking place into these shadows. And the shadows are essentially bank liability constructions, or the liability side of banks, and how they operated their various financial and monetary activities. So, you know, because there isn't good statistics on exactly what was going on at that time, especially into the 1990s, what I use is a couple of good anecdotes that give us an indication that all of the stuff that's out in the shadows is starting to have a very enormous impact on the financial system and thereby the global economy.
And on slide 24, you've got Warren Buffett's picture here. How does he fit into this story?
Well, the story of Warren Buffett is his takeover of Salomon Brothers, or a rescue of Salomon Brothers. And Salomon Brothers is a well-known bank from especially the 1980s. It was given prominence in Michael Lewis's book, Liar's Poker. And essentially what happened in the early 1990s, what was described as a rogue trader, a guy named Paul Moser, was bidding in excess for U.S. Treasury securities at auction, even though there wasn't an apparent reason for why he might do that. And throughout 1990, for example, Moser was bidding sometimes more than 100% for what was placed by the Treasury at auction. In one particular auction in June 1990, he bid more than 100% for Salomon Brothers accounts for the entire $8 billion in notes that was auctioned. Now, the Treasury Department noticed that this was taking place. And in fact, the Deputy Assistant Secretary, Michael Bansom, called Moser and told him, hey, knock it off. You're not supposed to be taking the entire auction for yourself. And eventually, you know, a week after that phone call, Moser did it again for Salomon Brothers. And that led the Treasury to create what was a 35% rule that they even named after the guy. But yet he persisted at it. Even after Treasury had defined a rule, Moser kept bidding for more U.S. Treasuries at auction than they were supposedly allotted for. And the point was that by August 1991, the Treasury Department had finally had enough, and they were so fed up with this tactic that they actually threatened to suspend Salomon Brothers, which led to Warren Buffett's intervention with the Treasury Secretary and even testifying before the House and Senate. Even after he took over rescued Salomon Brothers, he took out a two-page letter, or he published a two-page letter to shareholders in October 1991 in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the Financial Times of London. So this was a big deal for Salomon Brothers. Essentially, they were facing what was to them a death sentence by being kicked out of the Treasury market. And what was important about this episode was nobody could figure out what was going on. Why was Salomon Brothers threatening their own existence? The LA Times, for example, wrote a story in February 1992 talking about all this, and they called it Moser's inept little scam, because in the mainstream, they couldn't understand what was going on. Why was Salomon Brothers so intent on overbidding at auction for Treasury paper? From the outside, it looked like there was nothing. I mean, it was small potatoes. They weren't making a whole lot of money on the transaction, so it wasn't like they were buying paper for the paper itself. And in fact, that led to a government investigation in January 1992, a joint investigation from several government agencies, including the SEC, Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the NYSE, the NESD, the OCC, and all the alphabet soup of government agencies, to try to figure out what was going on, because their purpose was to maintain the integrity of the auction process. And what they found was that looking at GSE auctions of mortgage bond securities, everybody was doing this. They sampled, I believe, 98 dealers and found them all were overbidding for MBS paper at auction. Something was going on here. Why was it that all of these people were going to such lengths to obtain auction on the run securities? And they were doing so in flagrant violation of all of these rules. And often, you know, in the MBS side, the joint report on the government securities market found that some of the dealers were actually maintaining two separate sets of books so that they could do this. And again, I don't think even in the government report, it wasn't clear to the government, why were these banks doing this? And the answer to that was the rise of the repo market. The idea that collateral had become an important part of the monetary system, especially on the interbank side of how banks obtain funding. Getting funds from the repo market was so important at that time and had become such a prominent part of the overall funding side that these dealers were going to illegitimate lengths to obtain collateral.
So the description that you've just given, Jeff, I think covers probably slides 24, 25, and 26, where you're describing the things that you just described. What does slide 27 tell us about the role of repos and where they came into this story? Because it's just amazing that these banks would take such extreme risks and violate so many rules to, as you say, overbid for treasury paper. What does this slide 27 show us about the repo market and how it was growing at the time?
Well, it shows us again what we're talking about, the era of missing money and how repo was one wholesale avenue of what was not really missing. It had become an important part of bank funding. And so because it was such a rising important part of bank funding on the liability side, that meant because a repo is essentially a collateralized loan, that collateral is in high demand, specifically on-the-run collateral, which on-the-run simply means any security that is just auctioned off. So when the U.S. government sells its treasury bonds to primary dealers in the auction process, those on-the-run securities that were just auctioned off are the best, most pristine collateral out there. And so that's why these banks were essentially trying to get as much as they could possibly get their hands on the best prime collateral, because by the early 1990s, it had become an enormously important part of their funding dynamic. And that was true also of the MBS market, though at the time it was a much smaller component because the MBS market was still in its infancy. But even there, you know, you could see from the Treasury Department's report, or the government official report on the auction process, that if so many dealers were willing to overbid for what would become on the run securities, we can infer from that the importance of the repo market for each of these dealer banks. And by the early 1990s, it had become something that I don't think most people, especially most officials, really appreciated as the role in redefining monetary circumstances.
Before we go any further, Jeff, I think we need to clarify. You're saying that these banks are all overpaying for treasury securities and trying to take up the entire issuance if they can possibly get their hands on it. Now, bankers don't do something like that unless there's a return on it. So I've got to believe that their intention is going to be to do something that somehow involves a multiplier effect, that if they're overpaying for that collateral, they're going to use the collateral in order to achieve some greater leverage or something. How does that actually work?
Well, there's a couple different ways they can do it. And one of it is essentially to make sure that they have access to the most pristine collateral, which are these on-the-run securities, for their own funding purposes, number one. And number two is so that they have the best collateral that could be rehypothecated at the best price. And rehypothecation is essentially the multiplier of securities and repo transactions. In other words, if you hold an on-the-run security in your inventory, you can actually lend it out to somebody else at the same time you use it. In fact, you can lend it out not to just one somebody, but often multiple somebodies. And so in a repo market, it would not be uncommon for a collateral security, to be used several times to obtain repo funding. And so there was a multiplier effect where you start to appreciate collateral as itself currency-like. In other words, it had a value that was beyond just holding a U.S. Treasury or buying a U.S. Treasury from auction. It had a role in interbank financing of various balance sheets in various different ways.
And presumably, as that rehypothecation is occurring, it means that the same asset is pledged as collateral more than once, and that means that the underlying system is at risk, because if there's ever a default, there's not really collateral there to back all of the transactions that were occurring. Is that right?
That's correct. And again, you get sort of a multiplier of collateral. And so you can have a run in collateral, which in fact did occur starting in 2007, because you had rehypothecation of not just U.S. Treasury securities, you had immense rehypothecation of MBS securities, because the MBS during the housing bubble became an enormous portion of the repo market, and the way in which banks were funding their balance sheets through the repo system, using that as collateral. And so there was enormous potential for essentially a run on collateral, which again, we start to see the beginning parts of that in these early 1990s activities that at the time people didn't know what the hell was going on.
Moving on to slide 28, it looks like you've got a couple more anecdotes here to help us understand in the early 90s how the Eurodollar system was growing. Please elaborate.
Well, I think a lot of people are aware of the sterling crisis in 1992, if for no other reason that brought us the prominence of George Soros. You know, how was Soros able to supposedly break the Bank of England? And the reason was that there was currency trading in volumes that had, by early 1990s, become so large that they dwarfed anything that any central bank could actually put together. So it was relatively easy for the sterling crisis in 1992 for the Bank of England to be simply overwhelmed. And as you know, a couple of articles I have picked from that time period, you know, the one from the New York Times was marveling at the fact that there was so much currency trading that it was more than the 10 largest more than the market value of the 10 largest American companies at the time. You know, the fact that there was this immense offshore currency market that I think in many ways surprised people. They were not aware that this stuff was taking place. And again, we're trying to connect the dots between the missing money era of the 1960s and 1970s, as well as its offshore component. You know, recalling Milton Friedman's multiplier example of how the global supply of dollars was independent or growing independently of whatever the domestic supply of dollars was. And so by the early 1990s in the sterling crisis, what we get is a sense of the growth outside the U.S. in these wholesale formats, in the Eurodollar format, was immense. Even by then, throughout the 1980s, it had expanded to such a high degree that people were shocked in the early 1990s by what was actually going on outside the U.S.
Okay, Jeff, at this point in the story, we're up to the 90s. So by now, Alan Greenspan has taken over back in 87, I think, as the head of the Federal Reserve. And at that time, Mr. Greenspan was heralded by many people as the maestro, the genius, the smartest guy ever, God's gift to central bankers. I'm guessing that's not exactly your viewpoint. Fill us in on this next slide, 29, where we see Mr. Greenspan's picture and how he fits into this story.
Well, contemporarily, I don't know if even Alan Greenspan would have happened, of course, in the mainstream. Many people associate the period of the 1990s with Alan Greenspan in a very positive fashion. But if you actually listen to what he said throughout that period, it was in many ways like the missing money period of the 1970s. And even in his most famous speeches, like his 1996 Irrational Exuberance speech, for example, the reason he gave that speech was about this topic of missing money. What he said was, in effect, that the correlations with money demand, correlations even with money supply, had long ago gone way off the rails, had got to the point where the Fed couldn't predict even either side of the monetary equation. And so it was a difficult task for a central banker to try to handle monetary policy under conditions where they couldn't define money. And he wasn't explicit in stating that it had happened this way, that monetary policy had evolved into a discretionary format because they couldn't define money. But that is what he said in various hints and reading between the lines of many of his speeches. And so we have to recognize the fact that maybe the 1990s weren't exactly what everybody thought they were.
And of course, the big change in monetary policy of that era is that the Fed made a shift from targeting money supply to targeting the Fed funds rate. And we're seeing that here on slide 30. Tell us what's going on here and how it fits into the story.
Yeah, and we don't even know exactly when the Federal Reserve started targeting the federal funds rate. In fact, they've never specifically come out and said, this is the date we stopped targeting money supply or money demand, actually, and started targeting the federal funds rate. But when you're in a regime where you can't define money, either supply or demand for it, what do you do as a central banker? And what they came up with was based on Milton Friedman's work and Milton Friedman's principles, where inflation in particular is certainly a monetary phenomenon. So what they decided, especially in the 1990s, was that monetary policy would be effective, they assumed, if as long as inflation stayed low or within their target range. Of course, the inflation target at the time was implicit, not explicit either. But still, if inflation was well behaved, they would assume, only assume, that it was because monetary policy was effective. And the way monetary policy was determined was a discretionary approach to moving the federal funds rate either higher or lower based on essentially a seat of the pants type of assessment of the economy and the markets. And so that's what happened. The Fed flew by the seat of its pants throughout the 1990s, but because things seemed to be very good and very well behaved, especially in inflation, everybody assumed that the correlation there was between the economy, especially inflation, and monetary policy. In other words, Greenspan must have been a maestro for doing whatever it is he did. And in fact, Greenspan never actually came out and said exactly what they were doing. All he did was raise and lower the federal funds rate, but nobody could really determine, nor did he specify exactly how they did that. You know, what caused the Fed to raise the rate 25 basis points one day, and in the next meeting, maybe perhaps lower it. And in fact, what we know now today is that it was a completely discretionary policy that had absolutely nothing to do with money whatsoever.
Okay, Jeff, this is probably a good place to wrap up part two, since your next group of slides is discussing the role of the Basel Accords in the development of the Eurodollar system, and that's going to take more time than we have remaining today. So to summarize the key points that we discussed today, many people already know about the offshore definition of Eurodollars, which refers to time deposits denominated in U.S. dollars that are on deposit in banks outside of the U.S. banking system. But in this discussion, we reviewed the wholesale component of the Eurodollar system, which essentially allows U.S. banks to create money supply out of thin air through creative accounting. We learned that by 1974, the Fed realized that they really didn't know how to measure the money supply accurately anymore because the system had become so complex. We discussed how the repurchase system used by banks to facilitate short-term financing played a key role in expanding the wholesale component of the Eurodollar system. Officials at the time were challenged to even understand what was happening and didn't know how to categorize repo transactions because their full effect was not completely understood. Official statistics of the day did not accurately reflect the money supply that was being created in the wholesale Eurodollar system and the role that the repo market played in it. We heard the fascinating story of how major banks, Salomon Brothers most visibly, were overbidding for treasury paper in the early 1990s because they'd figured out a way to beat the system and rehypothecate the very best collateral assets, using them to collateralize multiple loans, thus effectively conjuring even more money supply out of thin air using the repo market to create wholesale Eurodollars. Jeff opined that the Fed's literal inability to accurately measure the money supply probably played a key role in the early 1990s policy shift in which the Fed began targeting the Fed funds rate rather than the money supply as a monetary policy tool. Jeff, I want to thank you again. Before we close, though, let's just give our listeners a quick rundown on what you do at Alhambra Investment Partners.
Well, I basically focus on dollars and Eurodollars. No, it's Alhambra Investment Partners is an investment advisory firm, a registered IRA. And what we do is try to make sense of the world so that we can invest intelligently and prudently. And unfortunately, in trying to do that in the last 10 years, and even longer before that, has been incredibly difficult because, as I hope your listeners have appreciated through the presentation here, the world doesn't look like it the way it's supposed to look. And so there's a lot more to this story that is very much relevant to 2017. Somebody once said that you can't know the future without studying the past. And I believe that wholeheartedly, and I think, at least I hope, that what we've done here will help people understand that as well.
We're going to leave it there for this episode, folks. Be sure to tune back in, though, for part three, where we're going to begin by diving into the role that the Basel Accords played in shaping the evolution of the Eurodollar system through the 90s and early 2000s. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great episode. Now, Jeffrey really started to dive into the wholesale euro-dollar system in part two. I was particularly interested to learn that the euro-dollar system was born outside of the central bank system and that the Fed had to learn and adapt to the evolving market. What stood out for you?
You know, when it really started to click for me, Patrick, was when Jeff got into the tri-party repo system and the story about the banker buying all of the treasury paper that he could possibly get his hands on, even though it didn't seem to make economic sense to do so. And all of a sudden, things that happened that I knew about in history that I never understood before suddenly made sense. And I guess what I would do is reinvoke that same Niels Bohr analogy that I used when we talked about part one. Niels Bohr was the physicist back in the 1920s. When he released his work, the whole scientific community just went completely bonkers, saying, wait a minute, if this guy's actually right, it means that a whole bunch of things that we thought we knew about how the universe works and basically the whole field of study of classical physics is wrong, or at least badly misinformed or incomplete in some way. And the analogy is, you know, it just filled in the blanks for me. Suddenly there were parts of monetary history that I've studied for years that I didn't really understood how things worked, and it started to come together. It's like, wait a minute, okay, that's why they're buying all this paper. It's because they figured out how to rehypothecate it to make more euro dollars. Okay, now it makes sense. So it was just fascinating for me. But you know, Patrick, it's really when we got into parts three and four that this really started to take off for me. Because just as you heard in today's episode about how the tri-party repo system played into this and that story about buying all of the treasury paper that they could, when Jeff gets into the Basel Accords that's coming in parts three and four, and all of a sudden, I'm stepping ahead. I'm like, wait a minute, I know what he's going to say. It's not that the people that were buying all of that mortgage paper were too stupid to see the default risk. They just didn't care. It gave them the collateral that they needed to make more euro dollars. They were gaming the system. All of the sudden things that I never understood leading up to the housing crisis, like how nobody saw that default risk, suddenly makes sense. It's just amazing how bankers are able to game the system. So as much as I really, really enjoyed this episode, folks, put your seatbelts on for parts three and four. It's fantastic content.
Now, Eric, since you teased the audience with parts three and four, what's your plan for releasing them?
Well, you know, originally we had planned to air today's episode Thanksgiving week, and then episode three was going to be Christmas week, and then New Year's week we were going to do episode four. And we've been getting a lot of pressure from listeners saying, hey, when are you going to give us parts two, three, and four? We want to hear it. So we're working to rejuggle the schedule. Now, of course, that means we've got to come up with something else to do on the holiday weeks. Well, we've got a really great idea that's still in the works, so I'm going to keep that under wraps for now. So we may have a plan C, if you will, for Christmas and New Year's week. I think that probably Thanksgiving week will be either part three or part four. I'm not sure which. And shortly thereafter, if that's not part four, we'll get it out after that. By the time we get to Christmas, certainly we will have had all four episodes out. I'm not certain at this point. We're just juggling some of our other guests and bookings. The problem we're dealing with, folks, is we've got some really, really fantastic guests booked this fall. So we've got to balance the desire to get you the rest of Eurodollar University with our other regularly scheduled programming. But I think probably by Thanksgiving, you'll have received all four episodes. If not, it'll be a three on Thanksgiving and four might be the week after that.
Now, Eric, let's talk about that dollar. Over the last month of episodes, we have focused extensively on the U.S. dollar. And now that we both have had time to absorb the Luke Roman and Mark Yusko views, I have to say, I am still conflicted with variant views on this. Look, I understand the foundational argument of the Luke Romans of the world, the idea that throughout history, a country with the worst balance of trade and the lowest reserves has had its currency weaken to bring the imbalance back into balance. But we live in a world where it's almost all of these Western world nations are pretty FUBAR'd. You know, I mean, when we talk about things like demographics and boomers and the associated pension crisis that is coming, that isn't really a U.S.-centric problem. I mean, in the end, the baby boomer and pension crisis exists in Canada, in Europe, in Japan. This is something that all these countries are going to have to deal with. But then when you look at Japan running these historically high levels of debt to GDP with devaluing their currency to deflate their debts away is like the only tenable long-term solution they have. Then you look at Europe. Now, it has very high levels of debt, but more importantly, yet that's coupled with these geopolitical headwinds of national unity. And you look at the real estate bubbles in Australia and Canada. We had, you know, Pete Worgen on last week, and we had Kevin Muir on the show a couple months ago, and both suggested that one of the ways to express this real estate short bubble thing is by shorting the Aussie and the CAD currencies as a way to express it, because these central banks will have to provide liquidity when these real estate markets turn. So I ask you, can these countries stand by and watch their currencies skyrocket against the U.S. dollar, you know, because of this U.S. bear narrative? To me, I just have a hard time kind of wrapping my head around that it's just going to be all bearishness. What's your take on that?
Well, I definitely agree with you. There's a conundrum here in terms of good arguments on both sides. To me, it's all about time frames. Now, I'm going to stick to what has actually been my longest standing view, and that's not the long dollar view, but something I decided a full decade ago is there's no doubt in my mind that the end game here is that sometime within our lifetimes, the U.S. dollar is going to lose its hegemony in the global financial system. It's going to stop being the world's reserve currency. It's going to stop being the sole preferred asset of central banks for reserve assets. It won't be U.S. treasuries are the only game in town again. These things are going to change. It is going to be massively, massively bearish for the U.S. dollar, for the U.S. Treasury market, and it's going to create a fiscal crisis in the United States of proportions that are going to knock your socks off, frankly. Now, the thing is, Patrick, all of this was predicted by economist Robert Triffin like 60 years ago, and he didn't get it wrong. He was just really, really early. And the thing that I keep coming back to is what I had concluded 10 years ago, at least. I thought really bearish views about the dollar, very similar to Mark Yusko's views and Luke Gromen's views. So I certainly don't disagree with those guys. The thing is, I think they may still be early. The view that I've had is that, and this is getting more recent now, I realized the shortcomings of being so bearish and thinking that imminently this has to change. Robert Triffin predicted it 60 years ago. It doesn't have to happen right now. It's inevitable. It's going to happen someday, but it's not right now. And the thing is, like it or not, the U.S. dollar and U.S. treasuries are perceived by the whole world as the favored asset. It's the safety trade. It's always into U.S. treasuries. And I do think that this de-dollarization trend is going to continue to pick up steam and accelerate. But right now, it's, you know, it's on the back burner. It's a glimmer in Sergei Glazyev's eyes. You know, if we see this new crude oil contract that's backed by yuan suddenly take off and dramatically take market share away from the Brent contract, oh boy, then Luke Gromen is not early, and it's time to really rethink everything. But I don't think that's likely to happen. I think that this contract for crude oil in yuan is likely to be a sideshow, at least for a while. And I think that, you know, my view is still the U.S. dollar benefits because there are so many problems around the world that as long as the dollar remains the hegemonic center of the financial universe and remains the world's reserve currency, the capital flows are going to be away from crises elsewhere in the world into U.S. dollars and U.S. dollar assets until such time as this de-dollarization trend really takes hold and there are alternatives and we get to the point where central banks are not favoring U.S. treasuries anymore and we get to the point where institutional investors around the world are not thinking of U.S. dollars as the safety trade, as the risk-free asset, but they're shying away from U.S. dollars because they see the default risk that's inherent to an overburdened debt system in the United States. United States and the questionable ability of the United States to ever pay it back in real terms. We're not there yet. Now, what I think about then is the old adage of don't try to predict what the market's supposed to do. Let the market tell you. So I start to focus on what are the signals, what are the indicators to tell me that that bullish view that I have about the U.S. dollar, which is not based on thinking that it's meant to be forever. It's based on I don't think the end game is really on yet. How do I know the end game is starting? What are the things to look for? Well, certainly, when we get to the point at some point where U.S. Treasury yields are rising, but the dollar is weakening. Now, normally, of course, the basic theory of macroeconomics is that if you have, on a relative basis, increasing treasury yields so that the differential treasury yield that U.S. treasuries are paying is more than treasuries in other countries are paying, that ought to cause capital inflows into the U.S. dollar as people want in on that game to get the better yield. If the dollar is weakening as treasury yields are going up, that means that people don't want the better yield because they're afraid of the default risk. So when you see that usual relationship of as the yield on a relative basis, in other words, when U.S. treasuries as compared to other countries around the world are paying better rates of yield, if that does not cause capital flows to move into U.S. dollars, okay, maybe the end game is on, but we're not seeing that yet. So I think that in the end game, for sure, Mark Yusko and Luke Grohman have it exactly right. They seem to think the end game is already started. I'm not convinced it is, and I think that there may be a last hurrah for the U.S. dollar. And when I say last hurrah, I don't mean for the next month. I mean for the next several years. And I could be wrong about that. Maybe the end game is on. If I think back to the fourth turning and Neil Howe, you know, the way fourth turnings go down is usually the worst of it is in the last, say, 5 or 6 years. And the very last couple of years are when things get fixed. So logically, if this fourth turning should end around 2030, 2031, then let's say it's around 2028 that, you know, the worst is over and we're into the resolution phase. That suggests to me 2024 to 2028 might be the crisis period where you could see the U.S. dollar lose its hegemony and a U.S. Treasury crisis could develop. So I definitely think it's not just in our lifetimes, it's not that far off. But hey, that's still, 5 to 10 years away. I don't think it's right now. And until then, it's going to be very interesting. The other thing to watch, of course, as a signal is the U.S. dollar is definitely bouncing now in a very persuasive way. If it continues to resume a secular uptrend, in other words, if we clear 103, the prior high, and we get moving to 105, 106, 107, it's not time for Luke Grohman and Mark Yusko to be right quite yet, although I'm convinced they will be proven right in the end. On the other hand, if we get, another point up to 94 here and it rolls over and we take out 90 to the downside and we're looking at 80s all of a sudden, okay, well, that tells me something very different. So I think we've got to listen to the market and let the market tell us when the end game is on. I have not seen evidence to persuade me it's on as of now.
Now, Eric, I need to ask you, we had a listener question from Dexter, who emailed us asking about something that actually touches on this very topic. And I'm going to paraphrase his email, but basically saying, look, all these smart people are seeing this end game coming, such as yourself, and we're talking about this eventual debt reset. And he says, obviously, there's a very low chance 20 years from now that the U.S. will look the same than it does today. But he's asking the question, is there a coherent argument that is everything turns out okay, and what would the rationale be? And I kind of look at that and I think of the thing like, okay, monetary systems reset and things change. Like, if someone was born, let's say, in the silent generation in the 1920s and 30s, they're alive today, they had the opportunity to live through three distinct monetary systems: the pre-Bretton Woods system, then the Bretton Woods system, then the birth of the euro dollar system, and our current fiat debt-based system that we're in today, this kind of petrodollar system. They would have lived through numerous ones. And the way I kind of look at it is change is the only certainty. I mean, we can't have things always stay the same. It's an ever-evolving process. But I think the question Dexter is asking, I mean, does this have to be doom and gloom? Or is there a way that this can all settle out in a way and everything be okay? What's your thinking on that?
Well, and I think it's not only a question of, certainly it doesn't have to be all doom and gloom, but also what you see in fourth turnings are radical changes in social attitudes. And we talked about this with Neil Howe. You know, all of a sudden, there are generations who think that socialism is a better system than capitalism, and maybe we should adopt that. And of course, I don't personally agree with that view. But the point is, we're entering an era here where there could be radical changes, things that we previously thought unthinkable. So what happens, for example, if there's another big quantitative easing program? We get to the point where instead of the Fed owning a quarter of the Treasury paper or whatever it is now, they own half of the Treasury paper or even more. And then they decide to just forgive that debt away. So you basically take the U.S. government's huge, enormous, outstanding Treasury debt, and you cut it in half by having the Fed forgive the portion of it that it owns. Well, what are the consequences and knock-on implications of that? I'm not sure, you know, but there are solutions that could come into play that we would have thought to be unthinkable previously. There's the idea of debt jubilees. There's all kinds of possibility. So I think it really comes down to a question of social moods and attitudes and everything else. But I don't think it has to be doom and gloom. We do have to get to the point, though. What I know is not going to happen is continue on the course in speed that we're on, which is double the national debt in the current system that we have every eight-year presidential cycle. Eventually, something has to give way and fall apart if we continue doing that. And how it falls apart, I think, remains to be seen.
No, absolutely. You know, the one thing I always say is, like, a lot of people think that things are good when things stay the same. But in the end, once you accept the fact that it's always changing and it's just always reinventing itself, and then that sometimes comes with difficult hiccups along the way, then, you know, it's just you accept that and you watch it evolve. Now, I wanted to move on. And we had another listener, Craig, who wrote us an email, and he was commenting. He said he was listening to the interview with Kyle Bass on Real Vision, and they were talking about being long volatility as being the best trade in the world right now. And Craig was wondering that if that was something we agreed with, and would an option strategy be the best way to express that kind of a trade idea? And so my initial response to you, Craig, would be the fact that the only way that I know of being long volatility is with a negative carry. Whether you're buying option premium that is time decaying away, or whether you express the trade long vol and you have the negative term structure and the VIX futures and things like that to contend with. The biggest problem with being long volatility is it costs continuously to be long vol. And therefore, to me, being a trader that wants to, let's say, try to profit from a long volatility strategy, you have to be somewhat right about your timing. Because someone, for instance, back in 2015 could have seen all of the same reasons to be long volatility that we see today. Someone who's been going long volatility since 2015 has just been completely destroyed from that negative carry. If you, let's say, wanted to express a trade with, let's say, a straddle or some other type of a way of being long vol, it's still going to cost a lot of money to stay that way. So unless you're right about the timing, that's the tricky part. What's your take on that, Eric?
Well, I think you can really drive home that same point that you just made, Patrick, by looking at the people that are short vol and why it's working for them. You take the Target store manager who, you know, turned $500,000 into $12 million or whatever it is that Mark Yusko talked about when we interviewed him recently. Well, how is it that that guy who probably doesn't even understand why he's making money is making money? It's not because he bet on short vol and the VIX went down in absolute terms. It's because there is that carry trade. And basically, each subsequent contract comes in at a higher number. There's a contango yield there. And if you stay short the VIX, even though the absolute number of what the VIX is trading at doesn't change very much, you're getting that carry. And the carry is really where the profit is coming. So if you're getting paid the carry for being short VIX, how can you possibly be long volatility without paying that carry? You have to. And I don't think there's any way around that. So as you say, if you can get the timing right, you want to be as levered up long vol as you can possibly get, like 5 minutes before it all blows apart. Now, there's been a lot of people that have been predicting it was all going to blow apart for as long as we've been doing this podcast, certainly longer than that, for years now. And they're going to be proven right at some point. But if you had gone long vol anticipating that, you would have lost all your money by now. So you got to get the timing right if you're going to play that trade. I don't think there's any other way around it.
And when you take a look at something like Jeffrey Gundlach taking that huge S&P put position back in August, and you know, on the announcement, the VIX jumped just on the announcement that he was taking the trade. But he went out to December and March, and he bought it obviously when the VIX was relatively low. So he was paying a lower vol premium when buying it. But I mean, at this stage, look, the stock market's rallying, and anyone who takes a trade like that over the last 2 months is just getting hammered by time decay. You know, maybe Jeffrey's going to be right. Maybe there will be an event between December and March. But right now, it's a pain trade.
You know, you're exactly right, Patrick, because I bought some S&P puts at about the same price that Jeff Gundlach bought them at. And, you know, he announced that because he said so, vol was going to go up. Vol did jump up. We made a profit on that trade in the moment. Now, not only is the profit gone, but I think that I'm down about 40% on what I originally paid for those put options because there's time decay there. So there's no getting around the fact that you've got to get the timing right. Speaking of getting the timing right, we're going to have to wrap it here for this episode, folks. You know, we really need your help, and we sure appreciate those of you who are able to donate to help defray our production costs. Share your research roundup emails with your friends and colleagues. Tell people about Macro Voices, because the more listeners that we have, and particularly the more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to recruit the very best feature interview guests. Most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. Only takes a few minutes. It's completely free. We won't spam you. We won't sell your email address to anybody. We'll just send you the research roundup, which is a free compendium of links to all of the coolest stuff we could find on the internet, as well as downloads from our feature interview guests. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
Well, the first thing you'll find is the link to the transcript for the actual part two of the Euro Dollar University. So anyone who wants to actually read over what they listen to, it's a great way, opportunity to kind of reabsorb the content. The second thing you'll find is the link to the slide deck that actually accompanies that Euro Dollar University interview. I also posted a link to another Jeffrey Snyder article titled Auto Sales Up Last Month, But Why? Our listeners will also find a link to the Variant Perception blog article discussing FX hedging, a hidden risk for Eurozone equities. There's also a link to a great article from Nick Cunningham from oilprices.com asking what really killed the oil price rally. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.